everyone, and welcome back to For the Curious and Confused, a podcast for people who want to understand different perspectives of the world through the people who inhabit it. I'm your host, Don McTaggart, and today's guest is Noah Healy, a professional algorithm developer and self-proclaimed recreational mathematician. Noah's interests focus on unpacking what game theory and information theory can teach us about financial systems and what outcomes result when these theoretical frameworks overlap with the legal system. He has pioneered a patent-pending system aimed at addressing limitations in traditional commodity markets and increasing widespread economic potential. These are topics I don't have much background in, so I'm excited to fill in some gaps of my personal knowledge during this conversation. So, Noah, thank you for sharing your time and being here today.
Well, thanks for having me here, Don. It sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun.
I'm excited. Yeah. So starting off, first, could you give us kind of a zoomed out short story of who Noah Healy is and what motivates him?
Well, born and raised in Charlottesville, Virginia, as I'd mentioned on the pre-call, that's where I am right now. I was basically always the kid in the class that was the best at the math, and I've rode that through school. Got out of college after getting a bachelor's degree, and then I got a 1-year fellowship to take some graduate classes in a department that was shutting down. And then I got a job at a dot-com. It was 2000, and that job was, jobs were easy to get back in the day. And of course, then I got laid off after a year because jobs were also easy to lose, because companies were going bankrupt. The next job lasted about a year. The job after that, a little bit longer. Then I got another job, which lasted quite a bit longer, about 6, 7 years, 6.5-ish. And at that job, they just had this policy that they had no career opportunities. You couldn't advance. And so I finished doing the job for which I was hired. I completely automated one of their core systems for them. And so I quit and decided to lean into my long-term interest in research on computational mathematics, which I had sort of started during my first tenure at my first job, just in this sort of desire to actually have some kind of idea what I was doing. And working in that, this wholly new idea fell out in my lap. And I've had a day job on and off since then, but for most of the last decade-ish, this is what I've been working on is promulgating a new way to operate a financial marketplace.
Very exciting. Yeah, I'm excited to unpack some of those. You mentioned tenure, so I guess we'll get to that about what where you've been through there. But you mentioned at the very beginning about being the kid who's good at math. So, and you identify as a recreational mathematician. So, can you talk a little about how you actually experience math as a person? Is it like colors or textures, floating equations, sense of interlocking systems, or something else? So, what does math feel like for you?
So yeah, I don't have synesthesia. So the numbers as colors and that kind of stuff, that does not happen for me. I know that it does for some, but that's not how it works for me. For me, it's very different across different forms of mathematics. But the sort of my math superpower, I think, is that my brain just can't latch on to nonsense. So for example, it's very handy for me that your name is in the corner there because names drip through my brain like water through a sieve. I'm not happy about that, but it's just something I've been learning to live with for, decades. And mathematics, because it in fact all hangs together and all makes sense, sticks. And so it's the subject I can actually think about and remember and comprehend. And I don't get distracted as I see many other people do, because I can't remember any of that stuff.
Is that related then somehow to the fact that it's all kind of rule based, or like the logic follows from one step to another? Because like my name is kind of on a very arbitrary piece of information. There's no
Right.
locking
Yeah,
information to it.
exactly. Arbitrary information does not stick well for me. Of course, there's not as much arbitrary information as generally supposed. So I was an absolutely atrocious speller as coming up through school. I'm still not a great speller, but I took Latin, and that actually forms the basis of a lot of spelling and even grammar rules. One of the decisions of when English grammar was formalized, sort of, a couple of hundred years ago, in its modern form, was to try to make it act more like Latin grammar. In Latin grammar, things like dangling participles are impossible because they're part of the word. And so, whereas we might find it somewhat unnatural or somewhat natural to just be able to say any English word we'd like to next in any given sentence, in Latin, some of those would be impossible. And, looking at modern natural language processing, we now understand that the amount of entropy in words and sentences is significantly smaller than, like, the log two size of the dictionary of the English language and so on. So, once you start apprehending these larger understandings, you can start making sense out of information that's a little more on the arbitrary side. But yeah, mostly for me, math is a distraction-free environment. And the some things, graph structure, or high complexity grammar parsing problems do sort of fit together when you get them right and not otherwise. But computation doesn't work like that. For me, it is, I can juggle the values in my head and sort of keep them stacked in ways that's useful by paying attention to relationships that exist and using the computation that's most convenient in a given portion. Whereas geometry problems, that's a visualization. And so when I'm working on geometry problems, then I'm working with my visual sort of manifestation. So it's I'm a little odd that I have a broader interest in mathematics than most of the other mathematically interested people that I encounter. But again, to me, it's more of math is the thing that I can actually pay attention to because I can remember it.
That's also, even within math, there are silos. I guess when you get deep enough in any topic, there are silos within the silo. One quick follow-up question from that. You mentioned computation and then also geometry. I think of maybe a combination of those two as like high dimensional space, I guess like for large language models, if you're trying to accurately map out all the relationships between words. You may not have much experience in this, but it's
Well,
just
that
something that I thought
is,
was curious, and if you have any thoughts on that or how you perceive
yeah,
those
that is
models.
one possibility. But well, for example, for me, and I will get to my thoughts on large language models, but one of the things that I find interesting is that, as best I personally can tell, the Euclidean algorithm for multiplying lengths. Or extents might be, I think, the exact best English translation of Greek. I'm not an expert on ancient Greek by any means. Looks to me to be log time. And the proved to be fastest possible symbolic algorithm is log time. So log n times log n
Could you unpack those a
in
little bit
speed.
for a general audience, potentially,
Yeah,
if there's a way
sure.
to do
So,
that?
In computation, there's getting the right answer, but there's also how much work you do to get the right answer. So you can add numbers by counting on your fingers, or you can learn the symbolic relationships that they teach everybody in grade school and do it with a lot less work. And if you're adding very, very large numbers, like if you're adding a couple of million digit numbers, which is something that a computer will do in, a handful of clock cycles, if you were doing it by counting, you would not be able to do it within the confines of our understanding of our universe, and neither would the computer. But if you do it by this symbol manipulation, a classroom full of third graders could do it. It would take them a few weeks, but they could do it. And the computer again can do it in, tiny, tiny fractions of a second. And so we can characterize how much work it takes to solve problems. And those characterizations are themselves functions of how large the problems are. So adding million digit numbers is about 1,000 times harder than adding 1,000 digit numbers using symbolic manipulation.
Gotcha.
The multiplication is worse than that. So multiplying 1,000 digit numbers, it would be around 10,000 times harder to multiply million digit numbers than multiply 1,000 digit numbers,
So then the
except
scaling laws really start coming in.
right. Except according to the Euclidean concept, you should be able to multiply, well, in Euclidean space, with some caveats that I think are solid, you can do it in only 1,000 times as much work. And that shouldn't be possible. So, a problem that I'm chewing on is why does it like it? Have I gotten something wrong about the apparent complexity of Euclidean multiplication? Is there some different property of the Euclidean plane that's incompatible with our understanding of symbolic mathematics? Or is there some foundationally better algorithm that our present understanding of symbolic manipulation has not made evident to us that we could actually transfer back from Euclidean spaces and use? And I think those cover the cases. And so
So if
to
I could
me,
try to briefly
that's
summarize
sure.
what you just said, just to make sure I'm on the same track with you. So this ability to do work in a way that is, well, to use these symbolic relations so that we don't have to do massive amounts of work, you've discovered some, maybe not discovered is the right word, but have pieced together some process where the scaling down of that amount of work seems to look possible, but it doesn't match with what we've been able to do previously. And so now you're in the back and forthing of determining if this is actually correct or not. Am I, how is that?
That's certainly fair enough.
Okay.
I did, yeah, I'm, I would put my contribution much smaller than that. I have noticed
Okay. Yeah.
something that
Yep.
looks
Yep.
anomalous to me. I might have made a mistake, but it looks pretty solid and it's very anomalous. And so that's something that I play around with. But yes, you're talking about the sort of fusion of linear algebra techniques with large language models and how we do computation on neural nets, and that allows the sort of projection of these enormous dimensional spaces and vectors around different systems. My system itself actually isn't so much based on that specific kind of space relationship, but a generalization of the use of metric spaces. So I found that by using metric spaces, you can create a computer program that will allow the driving of a specific strategic situation, which might exist among people, might exist among machines, might exist among people and machines, to become more efficient. And so spaces are an incredibly useful tool, in my opinion, mathematically speaking.
So to bring this back a little bit out of the abstract realm and a little more into the practical realm, could you please summarize your qualifications to help us understand why you're a credible source for talking about game theory and information theory and financial markets for kind of your main area of focus?
Well, primarily it's autodidact, but you're looking at about a quarter of a century of dedicated exploration of the mathematics of information and computation. Game theory is largely credited to Morgenstern and von Neumann, who von Neumann is also the guy that actually wrote or built the first sort of functioning computers. And the modern design of current computers is generally known as von Neumann architecture because to an arguable extent, with the sort of shift towards using these graphics cards, we're getting slightly away from von Neumann, but for primary computer architecture is still von Neumann architecture at its core. And he did a lot of contributions to a lot of studies. And in terms of that, economics essentially is game theory. It's just that they were crawling up a lesser part of the mountain, I would say. If you've ever seen or heard of A Beautiful Mind, that was about, and his name is escaping me, Nash, John Nash, and his work got him an Econ Nobel. There's a great story. Nash was at Princeton, which is where the Institute for Advanced Study, which is what employed John von Neumann doing all of his crazy stuff. When Nash had come up with his net, what became his Nash equilibrium ideas, he managed to schedule some time with the great man to sort of present his ideas. And when he started explaining the Nash equilibrium, von Neumann reportedly cut him off and said, "That's just a fixed point result. Do you have anything interesting?" Or words to that effect. So the unification of game theory with all of economics, for which we handed out a Nobel Prize to a certified genius, he's also a certified lunatic, but a certified genius, was so obvious to John von Neumann, he didn't really feel it was worth mentioning. So.
Man, yeah, those are the overlap of having extremely adept mathematical understanding, and also you said the word lunatic, but also like that general direction, because that's a great movie, A Beautiful Mind, and his schizophrenia showing up in that is really cool. So, well, not cool, but thought-provoking. A small tangent, I guess. Do you have any thoughts on that correlation of like people who have really strong mathematical understanding, but also tend to be in the asocial kind of direction, or if that's just a stereotype of nerds, or
Well, I
if there's
mean,
anything there?
it is a famous stereotype, and I think it's a famous stereotype for reasonable reasons. There are some very sad tales that are somewhat overblown. One famous one is the Infinity Guy, and his name is also escaping me. But I'm sure it will come back soon. But he lived to a fairly ripe old age. His wife died, and he had a certain paranoia about, receiving food from others, and he starved himself to death. in elder care, basically, because he wouldn't eat food that his wife didn't prepare, and his wife was dead. There are other cases. Alan Turing is also becoming much more sort of popularly well known. Was a homosexual. It was not accepted. He is officially considered to have committed suicide, although he had family members. His mother, for a long time, has fought to have his death classified as accidental. And there's a reasonably plausible story around that as well. So, I mean, one way or the other, but still, kind of sad end. But Leonard Euler was the court mathematician to Catherine the Great, had by all accounts a pretty decent marriage and, like a dozen plus children. The field certainly does attract its share of oddballs or and odd motivations. Isaac Newton, going back to Euclid again, is reported. We only have a single recorded instance of him laughing, and supposedly it was in Parliament. For a brief time, he was a member of Parliament, and one of his colleagues asked him whether, like, what value Euclid's Elements had as a work, and Newton reportedly laughed at the guy. But he was a lot to take by all accounts. As I've just said about myself, I think I can stick to mathematics because I can't get distracted by things I can't remember. Those things are the basis of ordinary human social interaction, which I'm not great at because I can't remember any of those things. So, I have a manner of speaking and a habitual mode of interaction which effectively never uses anybody's name ever. Cantor, that's the infinity guy who starved himself to
There we
death.
go. Yep.
As any sales class or self-help book on ingratiating yourself will tell you, names have a lot of power. That's just it doesn't my brain doesn't work like that.
Great. Thank you for indulging me in that tangent. So back to game theory and information theory. For those not familiar, you just mentioned that it's similar to economics and almost could be economics. Could you describe kind of what game theory and information theory is and how they kind of present in the world that normal people interact with?
Certainly. So, game theory is the mathematics of strategy. So it is the math of the interaction of decision-making agents. Those agents could be people, they could be animals, they could be machines, they could be natural processes. Anything that you can model as decision-making agents, works. And so you can create a game theoretic model of physics that would be somewhat Aristotelian, but would still match up with sort of our modern understandings of relativity and quantum physics, if you wanted to, where you would be ascribing sort of motives to blunt matter. Information theory was developed by Claude Shannon, and it's sort of what it says on the tin. It is the mathematics of signals and noise. Shannon was working at Bell Labs at the time, I'm pretty sure. And, the phone company was very interested in trying to figure out how to get more phone conversations that sounded great down its existing infrastructure. And interested in building as little and as robust new infrastructure as possible to get the most new, clear phone conversations that it could down it. And Shannon effectively created a complete set of mathematical tools that does literally everything that you could do in that space. There have been other contributions since then as people have discovered in other interesting sort of refinements. Another crossover between these two would be the Kelly bet or the Kelly criterion, where, and I can't actually remember if Kelly was his first or last name, but at any rate, Kelly, who was also at Bell Labs and liked horse racing, developed a relationship between knowledge and risk. So if you can ascribe certain probable outcomes to a set of possible actions, how much of your stake should you commit to each of the possible outcomes in order to maximize your long-term or in fact infinite term return over that set of decisions? And it's an implicit formula, so it does take a little bit of work to sort of apply in any given situation, but it just falls out basically. And for binary cases, it's quite simple. There's a direct form in the binary case, and so yeah, that's a direct connection between sort of information theory on the one hand in evaluating a situation to game theory automatically giving you this sort of idealized strategy.
So how do we start to understand how those frameworks apply to modern financial systems, I guess specifically in the United States?
Well, to do that, you actually have to create sort of hyper-modern financial systems, because the existing financial systems are literally medieval. We are using a financial system that was developed at the beginning of the Renaissance, and we didn't have explanations for how or why it worked until around a quarter of a century ago. Adam Smith's work on the Wealth of Nations, which includes some of the first sort of exposition and support of the what we erroneously call free market capitalism, was written in 1776, which is American citizens. We might recognize that year for other reasons. But that's it's been a little while since 1776. The sort of full rigorous claim of proof about the functioning of modern markets is something that in economics is known as the marginal revolution, and is pretty much the 20th century. So it's been 100-ish years that we have a belief that we understand how the market works at a theoretical level and a justification for its functioning. And the branch of economics that did that work is actually not the mainline branch that trains our economists. So, so they accept that that work is true, but they're out of a different tradition that also formed in the early part of the 20th century. And that's where that stands. Now, I have my own thoughts, and for me, looking at it, particularly adding information theory and the concept of noise to the system, I am convinced that the market design that we have had been using successfully for, 800-ish years actually effectively has failed and will continue to do so. And for the last third to half century, it got really egregious because historically it was the most powerful information network and sort of information decision machine that existed on Earth. And then we invented the internet and built something that was much, much more powerful than it. So just like you might be familiar with the concept of the 51% attack in something like a blockchain, where if you actually, spent many, many billions of dollars and built an array of computers that constituted 60% of the chain mining in the blockchain, then you could just rewrite the blockchain and say that it says what you says that it says, because you would produce, most of the tokens that say what the chain says, and that would be that. Like, it would say what you say it says because you'd be producing all the tokens. Now,
Really quick
it is
question. What
quite
is a
likely.
blockchain?
Blockchain is a computational object that, in theory, is being affirmed as true by a network of anonymous players in the digital space.
Okay. So, in terms of your thoughts on this, so we've been using this 800-year-old market, give or take, and that is producing, that has been the way to produce the most amount of information. And now we're entering a new era where the internet and other things are producing and can cipher through much more information. So how do your thoughts of how we can improve this come in with the limitations that do exist in the current system?
Well, so I think we have to replace it with something that is capable of working. And I can only really see two options. One is the work that I'm doing with the Patent Office and now suing them for. And the other is a sufficient general social collapse that we lose access to computational technology.
Those are both super interesting ideas, but can I first ask what characteristics of the market are not working in terms of how you're ascribing the market not working?
Well, the first and most obvious one is that it's becoming more and more costly, not only in sort of nominal terms, but also in relative terms. So the market is chewing up a larger and larger percentage of the total cost of operating our economies as our economies are growing. Think about, the relationship of your brain to your body. Your brain is obviously directing enormous amounts of what your body does, even things that you're completely unconsciously aware of. If over the course of your life, your brain consumed larger and larger percentages of the energy budget of your body, at some point, you would starve to death because you would still only be as effective as you used to be, but you would need so much more food that you couldn't actually keep going. That is the condition that we see with the increasingly frequent and increasingly sort of bizarre market failures that have been plaguing our system for decades.
Is this a result of a small amount of large players, or is this kind of an inherent property that now exists within all players? If that's a question that makes sense in this context.
It does, yeah. So it actually doesn't, strictly speaking, have anything to do with the players at all. It's a structural problem with how the market functions, in that it has with the resources that are available from the existence of computational technology, the mechanism that the market had to moderate a class of bad behavior, that is, the emission of nonsense, has vanished. And so it is now possible and profitable to emit noise, both within the market and broadly, socially and politically, which will then filter into the marketplace. And so destabilizing systems is now directly profitable to the destabilizers. And that means that whether people are sort of, intentional arsonists burning things down because they want to watch, it's sort of the Joker, they want to watch the world burn, or they're just accidental or unintentional goofuses that are doing things badly because they're doing things badly, the punishment will no longer come back to that action. And so that's the problem.
What is a practical example of that? Because when you say noise, I guess one reason or one example I think of is if you need to get some sort of funding approved for something, there's three or four levels of bureaucratic paperwork that has to happen. Is that the kind of noise you're talking about, or is there something else that this noise manifests
Well,
as?
that's a completely different branch of failure of our present systems. And I would strongly encourage you in the dealing with bureaucracy to look at Parkinson's Law, the Peter Principle, both of which are books. I've got Parkinson's Law on the shelf over here, actually. And there's also, they did make books out of this, but the television show Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister by the BBC. It's one of the greatest things they've ever produced. It's really hilarious. It's also all true in the greater sense. While it is fiction, it's as real as anything that's ever been produced on television. And so we do have overwhelming growth in our bureaucratic structures, and that is also a problem, but it is not the problem that I am addressing within the scope of the context that I'm talking about. So,
Okay,
practical
great. Yeah,
examples
so could you
of
yeah, so could you re redirect
noise.
my thought path to an example of what you're discussing? Yeah.
So, here's a couple of examples. Number one, flash crashes. So,
What is that?
back in the late 80s, there's another one in 2010 that were both general. So the largest single day loss of stock value as a percentage happened back in like 89, when the entire stock market went down. I think it was like 38-ish percent or something like that. It was basically a third drop single day. Everyone got really unsettled. It came back. That was the first day in the history of the New York Stock Exchange that they traded a million units, which doesn't sound like a big number by sort of modern standards, but was an absolutely enormous number back in the day. Another one in, I think, like 2010-ish, around there. I'm not great with dates, again, for the same reasons we discussed earlier. But there was another flash crash where the entire market went down after, a year of jitteriness after the global financial crisis happened, which is another example, but not one I'm going to get into. Both of those crashes were purely computer-driven trading phenomenon, where algorithms that basically exist to try to keep their owners from falling into quicksand, try to pull rugs out of other people so that those people fall into the quicksand instead. And basically the stars aligned and all the rugs got pulled at the same time and everybody fell into the quicksand. While those two are famous cases of this happening across the entire marketplace, it is in fact a daily phenomenon that flash crashes occur in single issues across our marketplaces, because while the stars rarely align across the entire marketplace, everybody is operating these sort of rug pulling algorithms to defend themselves against other rug pulling algorithms, none of which are related to actual economic conditions, and all of that sort of nonsense just gets out of hand frequently. Another example of how sort of noise can overwhelm signal, and this is one that I sort of standard use, is the Russian invasion of the Ukraine, or Ukraine. So Russia is, I believe, the third largest wheat producing country on Earth. It's really big. Ukraine is also a pretty decent sized place and is very fertile. And I think it was about fifth. When that invasion happened, the wheat market went absolutely bananas, as one would expect it to do. And wheat prices spiked pretty severely and were highly jittery. As a result of this, Canada and the United States, who are one and two, I'm pretty sure, I think Canada makes more wheat than we do because, northern climes is better. We can do more with corn and rice here. So our wheat farmers reacted to that news of wheat prices going through the ceiling by planting 0 new acres of wheat, because none of that price windfall got to the farmers. The those rug pulling machines were able to effectively absorb that entire windfall inside the marketplace and keep that signal from actually getting to where it would do some good. And they made money by doing so. So by making our economy function less efficiently and less profitably, the people who caused that to happen made more money. And it's not necessarily a case of sort of a single Machiavellian string puller that gets it all. It is within the structure of the capacities that exist, the natural incentives for every single person involved in the marketplace to cause that bad outcome to happen. And their collective action caused that bad outcome to happen. And it will inevitably do so again. If another continental scale disaster happens, whether engineered or accidental, that was unanticipated, then another opportunity to cause a bad reaction will be incredibly profitable for whoever happens to be around when that happens too. And that will be the case forever, because this system can't function if the financial system has access to the internet. So we can either not have an internet, or we could have a different kind of financial system.
That's a great segue into your ideas then. So the we've got these digital systems that are the rug pulling into quicksand machines. So is your are your ideas kind of around I think you say changing the parameters about who pulls the rug on who, or is it getting rid of the rug and getting rid of the quicksand, or what ideas do you have in how we address this?
So my ideas are around fundamentally realigning how the communication functions in order to emphasize and value signal exclusively. And so there simply is no role for this kind of rug pulling machine to exist, because they're offering nothing of value, not to their current owners, nor to anyone else within the system. So the recognition is that a deal, the current concept of a deal is that there's a buyer and a seller. So let's say it's you and me. You have something you want to sell, and I have some money, and I might have some interest in whatever that is. And so a deal is you and I coming together to agree on a price and a product. And in a commodity market, we pre-agree to what the product is. So like, let's say I was selling, I could like pull one of these books off the shelf and sell it to you right now, hypothetically. But that's just some, that's a book that I pull off my shelf. In a commodity market, we would completely, solidify exactly what was being sold. Train loads worth of corn or steel or oil that's this quality in this location at that time. So we don't have to agree on a product in this commodity marketplace. So all we have to do is to agree on a price. And again, we're not in isolation. Once we've fully standardized what wheat is, lots of people need to buy wheat. There's more than one baker in the world. Lots of people need to sell wheat. There's more than one farmer in the world. And so we can have this environment where, by looking at the other deals that are happening, we can decide what sorts of deals we're interested in offering and taking. And that's how the existing marketplace works, is this notion that buyers will offer deals where they put a price on how much they want to buy for, and sellers will offer deals where they put a price on how much they want to sell for. And when those prices match up, that deal kind of gets sewn together with a contract, and the contract gets honored. And if that's all it ever was, that would be fine. But in order for there to sort of be a company of people, have you ever seen penguins going into the water?
I don't think so. Not, maybe, no.
So penguins, when they're getting ready to jump into the water, they operate in sort of flocks. So they sort of crowd and they all kind of waddle up to the edge. But when they get to the edge, they stop. And they all kind of crowd up to the edge and sort of jostle until one or two of them gets pushed over. And then they go in, and then everyone just kind of jumps in and dives in after them. Or they go in and they get ripped apart by like an orca or a leopard seal or something, and then they all just back off. So if the trading environment was really just bakers and farmers, they'd do the penguin thing. They'd just be like, well, I don't want to offer, I don't want to offer the real deal. I want to like hang back and see what the real deal is. So somebody that's kind of brave enough to go across needs to exist. And they turn out to be most of the marketplace. That's where the speculators come in. And they're providing a real value. They're providing information to the marketplace. The thing is, in the current marketplace, they do so indirectly. I say, okay, so the deal is about having a product you want to sell, have somebody else having money that they want to buy with, but also information about what price deals should happen at. And so the proper sort of form isn't two pieces, a buyer and a seller. The proper form is three pieces, a producer, a consumer, and a forecaster. And if you're a producer, you can forecast also if you want to. And if your forecasts are matched, you don't even have to pay, you don't have to trade just because you forecast and everyone agreed with you doesn't mean that you have to do anything about it. But that's it. If you want to play games with prices, then you have to go play games with prices as a forecaster. You can't pretend to be a producer and then pretend to be a buyer and then pretend to be a seller and then pretend to be a buyer, pretend to sell, 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 buy, 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 the way they do right now. And by simplifying that structure, we can make each of these things much more direct, and that eliminates an enormous fraction of the information that's going in. And so, as an engineer, you'd be familiar with dividing energy into work and heat. Well, in information theory, we've discovered that information is, in fact, at certainly at the classical level, precisely analogous to entropy. And so, information in general formulation can be divided into noise and signal on exactly the same terms. So information that's useful to people is signal, and information that isn't useful to people is noise. And so by doing things like this, just as you can design a heat engine that will be more efficient than another heat engine by, improving which system, we can improve the thermodynamic efficiency of our information systems at the financial sphere.
Very interesting. So, in the case of this Russia invading Ukraine situation where we have these edge scenarios, what allows this producer, seller, and forecaster model to be more adaptive and receptive to those kind of edge cases?
Well, in the first place, my forecasters are earning money based on the profitability of producers. And so passing that price spike on to producers to encourage them to increase production in order to increase the value of what they're selling improves the commissions, which makes them more money. So the forecasters make money not by absorbing money on its way to the producers, but by ducting money to the producers and then sort of latching on to their fixed percentage on the back end of that.
Gotcha.
But in a broader sense, how unanticipated was that? So in the existing system, as I noted, there's a direct interest in unanticipated things happening, which means one, there's an interest in causing unanticipated things to happen. But two, there's also an interest in closing your eyes and plugging up your ears and not talking about boiling situations that might turn into unanticipated situations, because the less people are aware of things that might go wrong, the more likely there will be an opportunity for you to make a killing. So if the world flips on its head, there would not be a motive to cause chaos in the first place, not an economic motive to do so. And if you see chaos coming, there would be an economic and collective motive to figure out how to appropriately prep for that and communicate that clearly and obviously across the information space in order to keep the market as facilitated and functional as possible.
So in the case of this being a patent pending system or idea that you're talking about, could you talk a little bit about how that actual process has been of like doing the submitting it and what kind of feedback you've gotten and where that area is?
Well, so I'm going to start out and say that my experience is not typical. It might have started out typically. So I put in a provisional patent. If you have an idea and you talk about it publicly or publish it in any other way, then it is not patentable. You cannot patent public ideas. So if you have an idea and you think you want to patent it, go to, LegalZoom or whatever, and or just go to the patent office's website and file yourself a provisional patent. It doesn't have to be that detailed. Just get it in there, and that gives you a year. So I did that and spent that year trying to find an attorney to work with, and found one, and we got my full patent application in with a few days to spare on my year, and that went in. You can pay for privacy, you can pay for acceleration. I didn't do any of those things. And so it was about 3 years, a little less than that, for, well, all in a little bit more than that. So it's 6 months to get it assigned to a patent examiner, and then it was just under 3 years, or 2.5 years ish for them to take a look at it. So, it was like 3 years and 2 months from the time of my thing that I got my first office action back. And your first office action is basically rejection unless you screw it up. Because it's not their job to say yes. So unless you did something that is really totally useless but is sort of novel and they don't care, then they're gonna say no. And there's a few different reasons for them to say no to things. One of the earliest and easiest is novelty. There's that theory that there are no new ideas under the sun. That's probably not true, but there certainly have been a lot of good ideas that have happened. The patent office has an enormous pile of them, plus there's everything that's out there in the world. And so they're gonna pull out some stuff and say, "Hey, look, people have already invented this." So I blew through those pretty easily. We had some other contention and wrangling about how to actually draft various parts of the patent to sort of make it not be too broad, actually talk about what I'm talking about, all the rest of that stuff. In 2020, so about 5 years after my provisional patent filing, I got a notice of acceptance. You get a notice of acceptance, you pay a fee, they print your patent up, you get your patent. Unless they decide they really made a big boo-boo, in which case they write you a letter and somebody high up in the patent office has to sign this thing saying, look, we screwed up. We got something fundamental wrong here. This is something you're not allowed to patent at all. And you can dispute this with us or you can go away. They opted to do neither of those things. They didn't sign a letter and they didn't give me the patent. Instead, my examiner's supervisor left my lawyers a voicemail saying, I don't think we're gonna, whatever, like rumors, just, I've been told this, I don't have the copy of the voicemail. She told him, this isn't gonna happen. We went ahead and put in the fee anyway. And you get 90 days you don't have to get a patent after a notice of acceptance. You cannot pay the fee. And then after 90 days, it's over. And then it's over. It's public. So you can't patent it anymore. Neither can anybody else. So we paid the fee. The due date came and went. We got back, it was Christmas basically. So in the new year, my lawyer reached out and was like, hey, what's going on? And they said, we're gonna figure out why we're not doing this and we'll get back to you soon. So in April, they came up with their reason. They didn't sign the letter. And the reason they had was it was useless. They said, nope, sorry, this can't be patented because it's not better. I kind of hit the ceiling. It took a while to sort of get it through my attorneys, but we had a few different back and forths. And finally, in January of 2022, the mathematical proof that we talked earlier about this sort of structurally better computation, this is a structurally better computation than the kind that current mechanisms that markets use operate on. And that is a mathematically provable fact about reality. And so I provided one of those mathematical proofs. And my lawyers wrote it up in legalese and basically said, hey, look, you have absolutely no leg to stand on. If you want to try to stand on this leg, we'll sue you in court. What are you going to do about this? In February 2022, they issued a second notice of acceptance. We immediately applied, pay the fee, get that in there. 3 weeks later, they withdrew that notice of acceptance. And their excuse the second time is it's too useful. You're trying to get all of economics. Well, that's also ridiculous for, very different reasons, not least of which the language that they're objecting to as being overly broad was created in consultation with the patent office to be narrow. So it's their language that they said is narrow enough to be patentable that they are now saying, well, you could read this any way you wanted. It's like, well, you could, but you already didn't. So, like, what are we talking about here? At any rate, my attorneys were then told that it was out of the hands, like that this decisions were coming down from on high that didn't make any sense, that they didn't agree with, but they couldn't overrule. And so it didn't matter whether or not I could convince my examiner and his boss that we were right. They weren't making the decisions anymore, and you can't talk to anybody else. So my attorneys put in an appeal to what's known as the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, sometimes colloquially known as Patent Court. That appeal went very badly. The they They put in their decision in July of last year, so July 2024, and they resurrected the mathematically disproved claim that it was useless. They reaffirmed that the ridiculous claim that it was too useful. And there was also another precedential case that the patent court themselves had decided in 2019 that my attorneys had brought up to them. And they said that that case doesn't apply because that case was making user of computer in a market context better. And my system, well, one, user of computer is bad grammar, but my system, which is obviously and mathematically proved to be making the use of computers and markets better, was not, in fact, covered under making computer use markets better. So that's just totally pure, insane, nonsensical lies. And after that, you're done. You can't talk to the patent office anymore. So, in our civil system of government, we have three branches. If the executive is screwing you, then you have to go talk to the judiciary. And so I did. I'm pretty much out of money, so I had to separate from my attorneys and sort of get things lined up that way. But I filed an appeal to the Federal Appeals Court for the Federal Circuit. So this is the branch of federal court that handles disputes between citizens and the federal government. You can appeal the decisions, or they could, if it goes the other way and they could still care, they could appeal to the Supreme Court, but this is the second highest court in the land, and the precedents set here apply to the entire federal government. So this is kind of crazy that I'm just kind of out here doing this now. I put in my case in November. They had 30 days to come up with a countercase. They asked for an extension, which they got. So they just put their case in on the 8th of January, and I have 3 weeks. It turned out that that case actually had a typo in it. So the actual final form of their case just got published yesterday. They got their table of contents wrong in the first draft. And so, yeah, end of January, I get to put, by the end of January, I can optionally put in a rebuttal to the rebuttal if I want to. I'm working on that now. And at that point, my understanding is that some sort of selection process will pull together a panel of like three judges, and they'll read everything and make a decision.
That's quite the story. Been back and forth and up and down and sideways and other ways. Wow. Well,
I have the facts and the law and mathematics, most people think that there's no chance that I will receive justice, and so I have hope, I guess.
wow. Wow. Well, good luck with that. I'm sure that is, at this point, sounds like it's not quite over yet for sure. And that's.
Not yet, no. And yeah,
Yeah.
it's a crazy story. I was in putting the rebuttal together, I was looking back through the emails that I had with my attorney, as well as sort of reading the entire history of the case and so on. I've had a kind of severe medical incident on each of the occasions when the patent office has gone insane and made some claim that's just completely false. And this is not this th I'm not doing well with this one either, so we'll see.
Man, I'm sorry to hear that. I really wish you the best of luck with that going forward. I think in the interest of time, I'll probably ask one last question, and then we can finish up here. In terms of individual people like ourselves, what actions or behaviors can people like you and me take to bring about the best kind of future that maybe you're thinking of with more fair markets, or in general, a good future we can all live in? What actions can we take?
Reevaluation of the systems that surround us, I think, unfortunately, is absolutely necessary. We're living in what some people call the post-industrial age. I really, really dislike that sort of fourth industrial age. I think that those people are liars and morons, but we generally accept, historically speaking, that sort of the Newtonian revolution and the change in our understanding of physics and mechanics fundamentally altered economics, culture, and politics in ways that make it possible to live the way that we live and not the way that, like, King Arthur lived. Not that he's a real person, but that kind of thing. Discoveries of greater magnitude were made approximately one century ago. And so the common understanding that existed for the people that put together our forms of government, our forms of education, our religions, our forms of economics, about how time and space and energy and matter and imagination and thought work have all been falsified. And we have not really inculcated the fact of these falsifications yet. Many, many people can recite E equals MC squared. Very, very few people can recite E equals H nu. If you toss, Turing incomputability at people, they will stare at you like you have just started speaking a different language. We are going to have to find systems that integrate the tools that we have surrounding us in ways that make us functional and happy. And we need to understand that that means that we aren't going to be using the systems that we have. And that's a hell of a challenge
It is.
for people who have the interest and the ability, such as I hope myself, dedicating yourself to trying to find and solve these problems and hope that you can connect that back to ways in which they can come into use and value. For people that don't have those things, sort of understand enough not to value yourself above the necessity of the breakdown and not work against the fix as it comes. Keep an open mind. But these challenges are very foundational. Our philosophers have not yet done the work to reintegrate our knowledge of how logic itself functions into our understanding of how to live a good life. Neither have our theologians, and neither have our physicists, and neither have our leaders, whether you're talking about politicians or CEOs or, hedge fund people that are, active investors or whatever. Like, there, that just doesn't exist. And so the things that you see around you are going away. I don't know if you mind a current reference or not, but the LA wildfires are still ongoing as this happens. That is an obvious large-scale systematic failure, no matter which way you slice it. A story that has been largely overshadowed by that story, and rightly so. I mean, this story affects maybe 1% as many people. Richmond, Virginia, which is the capital of my state, last week, in a bad snowstorm for the area, but in worse snowstorms have happened in this state in my lifetime. They had a cascade failure and they lost water in the city and parts of a couple of surrounding counties for about 4 days. And so if the world culture capital hadn't been on active fire during that exact same time, that would have been a pretty major story in all likelihood. And instead, that just happened. We will see more cascade disasters and other kinds of general social failures because these systems were built without the knowledge of reality that we presently have, and they have not been updated to that knowledge yet. And we got work to do.
There's a lot of work to do for sure. Yeah, those are some great challenges, great goals. A little bit scary, but yeah, it's nice to be talking about how we can start thinking about them. Well, Noah, I've
Well, I'm just one quick on the hope side. Very few people living today would voluntarily exchange the kinds of lifestyles they presently have for the median lifestyle of 500 years ago.
Very true.
And the shift in capacity that is potentiated by efficient information systems makes the shift in capacity of efficient energy systems look trivial by comparison.
That is a good thing to always keep in mind. Yeah, I think most people would not want to go back to the 1400s and live. Well, no, this has been a really great conversation. I really appreciate your time and unpacking some of these ideas around financial markets and what insights you can have on them. So, thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me here. This was fun.